And thank you for joining us this morning. In the verse that Marilyn just recited, there are sort of two components. One is the component of sangha, of community, of practicing, going as a river together, being an organism, cultivating peace together. So that's one aspect I want to talk about this morning, the aspect of community, which not the first time we've talked about it, but I think day by day it becomes more essential and meaningful. And the other thing is the sort of last part of the verse. May we be free of the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex. And listening to that, I was struck, this is it. If we could rid human beings of their superiority, inferiority, and equality complex, most of the human problems that human beings cause for one another would disappear, right? It is only people who think they are superior to other people that can act in a way that causes suffering. And when how are we superior? We're superior because we are, there's so many ways, you see. If you look at all the issues, people who think they're superior kill in the moment people who they think are their inferiors. People think they're superior because of the country, their country, nationalism. People think they're superior because of their gender. People think they're superior because of their race. People think they're superior because of their religion. People think they're superior because of their economic status. People think they're superior because of their education, or they think they're superior because of their intelligence, or, lots of ways that people and peoples think they are more deserving of others. How would you sum that all up? Superiority complex. The self that stands apart and thinks it is better than. My needs are superior to yours. My need for safety, for security, for food, for water, for air, is superior to yours. So I think this superiority complex is quite profound. The inferiority complex, I think I don't need to talk about, but it's sort of the other side of that. It is often the result of that. And again, the equality complex is a little different, but I think it certainly plays a role. So may we be free of the superiority complex, the inferiority complex. So I think the issue is, how did we get here, you see? I think this is one of the fundamental ways that Buddhism approaches the world, and certainly the world, we need to look deeply into it. I remember a number of years ago, I was on a panel right here on veganism, and there was a physician who was there. He's a cardiologist at our local VA, and I think we had heard about him, or I'd heard about him, or somebody brought him to my attention. And he spoke, and he was a very interesting guy because he talked about that he was just a typical cardiologist, busy, busy every day, treating people, putting stents in. And one day, for some strange reason, he looked a little more deeply as to why these people are showing up nonstop in his office And he kind of looked at variables, and I mean, and he came to diet. Very significant. He saw, you know, there's one, I mean, these people, many of them are not smokers, or, you know, a lot of the other risk factors they don't have, and yet they have significant heart problems, that they need a stent, or they've had a heart attack, you know, preventative, and he was diet. So he investigated that, he looked more deeply, and he got in, he realized, you know, it was the consumption of meat and meat products that was a significant a contributor to heart disease. And then he began to look at other areas of lifestyle. And we are like that, you see. We are all in the waiting room. And we have our symptoms. We have our diseases. And all the ailments of the world, we could look at as diseases. Violence is a disease, hatred is a disease, intolerance is a disease, injustice is a disease, right? These are all diseases that we have, as human beings have. These, and the daily news is simply the manifestation of those diseases manifesting into symptoms. I mean, we look at our culture right now with this coronavirus, and we see how quickly, when it threatens us, you know, immediately we, you know, some of us or some of the world, you know, looks deeply into, you know, what is this virus? What type of virus is it? You know, what's causing it? You know, the whole etiology of what's going on, looking for what? A cure, as well as future prevention. You see, we look deeply, we look below the symptoms to what's causing. And this is not easy, because we live in a world where we're just flooded with information, every day. It's simply what's happening right now, the endless symptoms. And very few people go underneath, and even when they go underneath, from a Buddhist point of view, they're just, you know, looking at underlying symptoms, deeper symptoms. But what is the real cause of all this? And in Buddhism, we talk about, you know, we don't want to keep trimming the leaves of our life. The leaves are what's most obvious. So we don't want to keep trimming and pruning the branches. But most of us are, you know, self-improvement, pruning ourselves, we're taking medication, you know, we're always pruning. We want to see that all the leaves are connected to branches, and they're all the branches are connected to bigger branches, and they're all connected to a large trunk, and the trunk is nourished by the roots. What is the root? What is the root cause of our condition? Why have we ended up in the world where there is such pervasiveness of superiority, inferiority, and equality complexes? But and again, for those who don't understand the equality complex, it's not the social equality, so it's something else. But I don't want to get into it today. So in the Buddhist tradition, psychological tradition, there are what's called the 12 links of interdependent origination. This is caused by this, which is caused by this, which is caused by this, which really addresses what I'm talking about. And it can be done working backwards from like the manifestation of what's going on in a very direct experience, or it can be begun at the other end. And I thought it'd be interesting if we began at the other end this morning, and I'll take some license with the traditional variation. So I invite everybody to close your eyes. Relax their minds. just be present, just really relax. Don't try to make anything happen. Just be here. At ease, relax, not trying to control anything. And let's take a little bit of an inward journey. All the way back. But let us also take a look directly into our mind that is traveling back. Stop traveling back for a moment and just turn within your own mind and just look directly into it. Usually when we think about our minds, many people think about thoughts or feelings, which are things that arise in the mind. But just for a moment, take a look directly into that, you know, which is aware of thoughts or which is aware of feelings or which is aware of listening right now. Just look directly, very simply, just turn. And you're sort of like, you know, it's as if you're the mirror and you're seeing yourself. Reflecting. You're not focused on the reflection anymore. And what happens when we turn like this and we look directly into our mind? The most simplest thing that happens is we see there's nothing there. There's no me, there's no I. And everything sort of quiets down when we look directly at our minds. So when we look into our mind, into that which is aware, into our own fundamental awareness, we see that really there's nothing there and it's all very calm and relaxed. And yet when we look out, we see lots of things. Endlessly we see things. And we have lots of opinions, lots of ideas, lots of projections, lots of everything about the world. And yet when we look into our mind, we don't see anything really. And even our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions are just arising and coming and going. No stability, no consistency. And yet when we enter the world, we seem to have many hard and fast ideas, opinions, rules, likes, dislikes, issues. So let us see how this happens, just very personally. We're not now thinking about the world. We are just within ourselves. So please, let's journey back. Being aware of this kind of paradox that when we look directly in our mind, we don't really see anything. And yet when we are going about the world or letting our thoughts just run, we have thoughts and opinions and ideas and likes and dislikes and attachments, aversions about everything, nonstop. What's going on here? We're looking more deeply under the surface. So let's go all the way back. And for those of you who cannot go all the way back, sort of use your imagination to go all the way back. But be aware that when we were born, and just feel this from the inside, we have no language, we had no thoughts. See if you can just imagine. And all of us, and everyone is the same. Everyone, when they are born, They don't have thoughts, they don't have language, but they do have awareness. If you've looked at an infant and they've looked at you, you know they're aware. They're very present, they're very aware, they're very alive. And they look at you. So just see if you can, just even in your imagination, imagine that this is where you started in this life. You didn't have a name for yourself. You didn't have a name for anything. You didn't have an idea about anything. Can you just imagine for a moment inside? Just imagine what that's like. Simply to be aware, without being able to label or define anything. And yet, totally alive, present, and aware. No problems, no issues. If there are so-called problems, they're very direct. Cold, wet, hungry. We know very clearly when we're comfortable and uncomfortable, but it's visceral, it's direct experience. So that's where every human being begins, in this kind of state of purity, we might say. Our minds totally uncontaminated. And we're just aware, which implies a kind of openness and presence to all experience. That's where we all begin. Every human being begins here. Please be here. And then what happens, you see? Then what happens? We are born into the care of, let's say, our parents. Now they have words. They have names. They give us names. They give us words. They give us labels, and they encourage us to develop labels for everything in our world. We learn the names of things from the world around us. And most significantly, they give us a name for ourselves. They give us each a name. And they tell us, this is you. And this is me, they tell us. They give us their names. And they kind of give us words of kind of ownership, like, this is your toy. This is mine. You're my child. I'm your mother. I'm your father. They begin to give a sense of kind of ownership. But our parents also have more complexity to their minds. They have personalities, they have identities, they have values, they have perceptions, they have ideas about themselves and the world. And they pass it on to us. Some unconsciously, just by being in their presence and living with them. Some very consciously, they train us They pass on their views, their ideas, their likes and dislikes. They pass on their identities. Now, where are they getting theirs from? Well, they got theirs from, you know, the way they were raised, but they're also in the world. You know, and in this world, there's all kinds of ideologies and ideas about religion and society and race and money and value, and right? So they're very conditioning and historical. I mean, there's so many economic, social, so many things that have impacted them that they are now transmitting to us. Can you feel your mind beginning to, we call that develop. But all of a sudden, without even consciously knowing, you have a name for everything. You have an identity for everything. And already you're developing all kinds of ideas about yourself and life that you are incorporating, and yet you're just absorbing it from the external world. We really have very little control over what's being put in to this original pure awareness. And again, depending on what it is and the quality of what it is and everything, we're beginning to incorporate our own views. Now, combine that with another thing that's developing, which is self. This way that we identify everything that is happening as it's happening to me. It's not just happening, like when we were young. Now it's happening to me. And so we begin to construct unknowingly an identity. And it's not just a name of, like, say, Fred or me. It also has all the stuff that I've gotten, all the ideas and the values and this, but also lots of, I'm having experience too. So I have my likes and my dislikes, things I want, things, you know, right? And I'm relating that all to me. I like this. I don't like that. I want this. I don't want that. I need this. I don't need that. And it's just kind of, it's all growing. You know, we go to school. We encounter other kids and teachers, and we learn how to read. And now, more. And we think we're just taking it in, but we're not, because already, from those early years, our minds have already been very conditioned. And we already have a fairly sophisticated growing over the years, self-identity of who I am, who I'm not, kind of person I am, good, bad, superior, inferior. And depending on how our self is developing and depending on how it's been constructed, we then develop this whole emotional life. When we don't get our way, we are angry. When we get our way, we're happy. When we lose something we value, we get sad. When we're concerned about how people are judging us or whether we're going to win or lose or, you know, what's going to happen to me, we get scared. We get anxious. We start comparing ourselves to others. And based on what? I mean, little babies don't compare themselves to others, do they? No. And they don't judge themselves about their abilities, about their toileting habits, about their eating habits, do they? They're free of all of that. But by the time we are a little more older, you know, we are no longer free of that. We're very self-concerned. Very concerned about how people perceive us and how the world perceives us and how they judge. And we now internalize all that within ourselves. Right? And we are now interacting in the world totally based on our conditioning. And we don't know it. And everybody who's listening to me had a different experience. And we are the product of that experience. And we think it's me. And then we go out into the world and we go to school, you know, I mean, and we develop. And now we can vote. Now we can take stands. Getting very dangerous now. Now I have rights, right? So I am free now to act out in the world based on the way I see it. And based on whether, you know, I think I'm superior to others or inferior to others or just as good as everybody else, I act in a certain way. And then we clash. Egos clash. Groups of egos clash. Groups of egos find each other. Because who do we like to hang with? We like to hang with people like ourselves, right? Now with social media and all this kind of stuff, we're more able to really find each other much quickly. Sort of like the virus, you know, there's always been pandemics and epidemics, but if you look at the history of them, they kind of went slowly. But now it's like, whew, right? What, in a month or two, it's all around the world. So not only in terms of social media, the internet and all that, communications, but also in terms of travel and trade and all that, we connect with each other. We interconnect with each other at a much deeper, faster level than ever before. And yet it's primarily around superficial things. And the virus just, even though it's toxic, it's a disease, it just spreads, right? Always looking for a suitable host. Just the way ideas and, I mean, all this stuff just spreads, okay? So now we have the world. And if you want to know about the world, just read your newspaper. Well, we don't read newspapers anymore. Just do whatever you do. And there it is. And it's changing all the time. I mean, once month is this issue, next month is that issue. And because we can't keep all the issues, you know, it's like we just go from one to the other to the other. And then we find, I thought we solved this one 50 years ago. I thought we settled this 100 years ago. Well, we didn't, did we? Because we were under this delusion that somehow laws and regulations and all this, which only regulate what is observable, which is actions of the body and speech, right? But the mind cannot be seen. The mind is not observable. And because we have thought that by regulating, legislating people's actions of body and speech, that we're really significantly changing anything, from a Dharma point of view, we didn't. Because of the three, body, speech, and mind is the ruler. Mind is the chief. In old feudal times when Buddhism developed, it would say mind is the king. And the speech and the body are just servants of the mind. So this is why, according to Buddhism, a doctor not knowing that there's a deeper cause of why people are showing up, it doesn't mean they stop treating people, not stop helping people, right? Oh, you're a smoker. Get out of here. Just because you have lung cancer, you know what I mean? Or you're a sugar addict. You know, get out of here. You know, you're overweight. Get out of here. Right? You see what I'm saying? That would be cruel, wouldn't it? But if nobody ever stops to ask, what is the cause of what's going on? You know, why is there so much anxiety among young people? Why is there so much depression among young people? Why is being on medication normal? Right? Why is that? What's the cause of it? So it's very important. But you see, most of us have forgotten where we began just 15, 20 minutes ago. You see, we've forgotten that. We've forgotten that within ourselves, and we've forgotten it for everybody else, those we agree with, those we disagree with. That everybody begins with a pure, natural mind. That is the root of everyone's mind. Now, in the Buddha's enlightenment, he was able to overcome his conditioning because he got to the root of his mind and he discovered that his pure, pristine awareness was still totally here, totally functioning, and the immediate experience of it was liberating. And all the delusions, the house, the constructed house has fallen. That's what he said in his enlightenment. He said, the whole construction of self, the whole construction of all my thoughts and ideas about life fell to the ground. And I was left with this pristine, pure awareness that I now know is me. He called it Buddha nature, awakened nature. And it has a knowing, and it has an intelligence, and it has a purity, and that this is here, right now, that everything's been constructed in our mind over it. It covers it, but it's still here. And so that's what the Buddhist path is about. And according to Buddhist teachings, as long as we are dealing only with symptoms and not treating the cause, symptoms will endlessly, endlessly manifest. And people may get healthy for a while, the world may get healthy for a while, cultures may get healthy for a while, but then it'll pop out over here, it'll pop out over there, right? And then we know that even as individuals, that happens, right? Things go okay for a while. We work through something, right? I mean, our society, we spend, a significant part of our population spends their life working through issues. And yet they don't find there's ever an end to it, right? Just endlessly new issues pop up, just when we thought. Why is that? Because we're still in the constructed house and we don't know it. So I want to, so this is the kind of the very personal way that the Buddhists at the deepest level look at the world and the people in it and what's going on. Now, the other thing that Marilyn was going on and on about in her verse was about community, Sangha. And in this day and age, even though he can no longer speak since he had his significant hemorrhage, Thich Nhat Hanh is really probably the man who's kind of looked deeply. And so I've gone back, and I was fortunate to meet him in the mid-70s when he was still very much talking in the way that I want to share today. So first I'm going to read from a book that was published in the mid-70s called The Raft Is Not the Shore. It was a series of dialogues between Thich Nhat Hanh or Thay and Dan Berrigan. Dan Berrigan, for those of you who don't know, a Catholic priest, a Jesuit, but also a very wonderful man and a very strong war resistor to all violence. I mean, right from then, he was just a wonderful being and part of a whole community, including his brother, who was also a priest, who I'd also met. And they founded what they called communities of resistance, which were spiritual communities to primarily resist violence and war at the time. This was the 70s, remember the Vietnam War. And so they met and they had like formal dialogues. And actually the first time I met Thay in Paris, Dan Berrigan was there. They were in process of having their dialogues. So this is a book, The Raft Is Not the Shore. And so Berrigan had just talked about his communities of resistance, which were you know, primarily Christian communities that had a very strong resistance to war. And then after Berrigan had talked about that, Thay said, "I think it's a very meaningful term. And resistance at root, I think, must mean more than resistance against war. It is a resistance against all kinds of things that are like war. Because living in modern society, one feels that one cannot easily retain integrity and wholeness. One often feels that one has been robbed of one's humaneness, the capacity to truly be oneself." And a little further on, he goes, "There are so many things in modern life that can make you lose yourself. So perhaps first of all, resistance means opposition to being invaded, to being occupied, assaulted, and destroyed by the system. Now, please understand, when he talks about the system, he's not talking about like specific systems, like we talk about what? Capitalism or communism or fascism, or he's not talking about those kinds of systems. We'll find out what he's talking about. The purpose of resistance here is to seek the healing of yourself in order to be able to see clearly. This may sound as though this falls short of a positive, you know, an act of resistance. Nevertheless, he says, it is the most basic. I think the communities of resistance should be places where people can return to themselves more easily, where the conditions are such that they can heal themselves and recover their wholeness. And then a little later in their dialogue, he says, I look, and he had tried in Vietnam to form a community like this. But the war had totally uprooted the whole thing. And he says, I look for communities of resistance, beautiful, healing, refreshing both in surroundings and in substance. In such communities, you can meet people who symbolize a kind of freshness. Their look, their smile, their understanding should be able to help. And then he talks upon other characteristics. So for me, this is when I first learned about communities of resistance from Thay. And And that Sangha, for him, was a community of resistance, which was very interesting. For most of you know that traditionally Sangha really has to do with the Buddhist, you know, those who practice the Buddha's way. The Buddha Dharma is the Sangha, and usually it's called the Fourfold Sangha, right? There are, based on the kind of vows one's taken, there are, you know, in the Sangha, there is the ordained monastic Sangha, nuns and monks who take hundreds of vows and live, as you know, a celibate life and a kind of a life, you know, somewhat removed from the world. And then there are lay people like ourselves who take the five mindfulness trainings or precepts and practice within the worlds. But traditionally, their roles and hierarchy are very different. And so that's kind of the traditional meaning of Sangha, but you can see Thai, it means something totally different. Communities of resistance, and actually in it, he actually says that he thinks ideally Sangha should be, but they're no longer. He said, because in the monasteries or whatever, people just pray and meditate, but they don't really relate to this deeper disease, which is in his culture. And actually the community he founded in Vietnam was a community in which monks and nuns and lay people were equal. And there actually were no rules. Being a monk with 250 rules, he must've found that very liberating, but they had no rules. So I'm just showing that to see that Thich Nhat Hanh's view of Sangha is more than just a community of practitioners, where it's often meant, you know, people who come together to practice the Buddha Dharma, to learn the teachings, to learn the meditation techniques, and to practice together them. Right? That's kind of a traditional view of Sangha. Thai sort of something else, because he looked very deeply into society and the problems of society and the materialism of society, right? How people are turned into commodities, how people are turned into economic units, and how people's aspirations in life is simply to accumulate things, have more, 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 right? And so, he saw that there was something going on in society, coming from a traditional society, grown, having been born into a small village, etc. I think, you know, when he began to encounter the 20th century, both, for, you know, not only the culture of it, but also the war, you know, the violence of it. Again, his response was to look deeply. And what can be done? And we know he was a war resister, to the war in Vietnam, but his most significant postulation of remedy was creating communities of resistance that resisted this empty, you know, empty culture, junk culture, like junk food. It really gives no nurturance. It really isn't nurturing. It really isn't nourishing. How do we resist this junk culture that gives so much and yet there's nothing of any worth in so much of what we consume, and that it's a place where people can come to heal? To heal and transform. So one of the first books that was published in America by Thai was called The Zen Keys. Very profound book. I really hope, if you haven't looked at it, you take a look at it. It was originally published in French, and I was somewhat involved in bringing it out. I mean, very smallly, but I knew people to be the translator, and I work with Kaplow on the introduction and stuff. So I just want to read a few things to give a sense of Zen and Thai and the path. He says, the picture of an enlightened person is that of a free human being who possesses spiritual force and who is not the plaything of chance, right? Remember we talked about all our conditioning? That's the plaything of chance. We're born in a certain family because of who they, you know, and then up to now our life, we are the plaything of chance. Enlightened practitioner sees themselves in their true nature, knows themselves, and possesses a clear view of reality. The reality of who and what they really are, their true being, and of their social situation. This is the most precious fruit that Zen can offer us. The way of living an enlightened life, of being an enlightened person. Now, enlightened, don't think like that's the Buddha. The Buddha is great enlightened. All of us have the capacity to be enlightened. All of us have the capacity through our practice to touch the pure nature within us. All of us have the capacity of learning to see clearly, to know nurturing, nourishing food from junk food. We all have the capacity of being enlightened. The light goes on. The way of enlightenment is considered to be the most fundamental and most beneficent contribution that we can make to life. It's a living tradition that can make sober. I don't know about sober, because I think sober we think about in terms of intoxicants, but I think meaning somebody who's not, you know, not a lightweight, healthy, well-balanced, and stable people. Zen has this, Zen enlightenment gives this kind of sobriety, vitality, and serenity. And this is an issue. I'm sort of, I don't usually read like this, but I think it's so important, and why should I paraphrase? He says, the problem that faces us is the problem of awakening. Did anybody read that if they read the paper today? If that's the most significant problem that we were facing today? He says, the problem that faces us is the problem of awakening. What we lack is not an ideology or a doctrine to save the world, right? I mean, we've had ideologies and doctrines to save the world for thousands of years. What we lack is awareness of who and what we are and what our true situation in life is. And the reason we did this exercise earlier is to see how far we have gotten away from ourselves and who and what we really are, truly, and how we've all gotten lost in this conditioned, fabricated self with all the views and light, you know what I mean? That is, we have been the playthings, unwittingly and unknowingly, of our causes and conditions. Through this awakening, we will discover our human sovereignty. Our situation is that of a person who's mounted on a horse, and the horse does not wish to obey its master. Right? So we were just lost in our conditioning. The world is lost in its conditioning, lost in its historical forces, passed down from generation to generation. Right? And nobody just says, stop. No, nobody says stop. They say, do this, do this, do this. Think this. Don't think that, think this. But this is not our way. Our way is to stop and learn how to be present and learn how to look deeply so we can really understand both our personal situation as well as the situation of the world. So he says, the way of salvation is therefore a new culture in which human nature can discover itself. I mean, anyhow, this is his last chapter of the book called The Regeneration of Man. And please forgive, women, please forgive Ty, but that's the way, you may not believe it, but that's the way people used to talk. Even somebody as open as him. It was the language of the time. And then I think he says something which is very profound, especially in this age. And now we're seeing once again the development of social movements seeking change. And he says, as I've already written, what we need is not a doctrine, but an awakening that can restore our spiritual force. What made Mahatma Gandhi's struggle a great success was not a doctrine, not even the doctrine of nonviolence, but Gandhi himself. In our day, and this is in the 70s, a lot is written and read about the doctrine of nonviolence, and people everywhere are trying to apply it. But they cannot rediscover the vitality of the kind that Gandhi had. The reason for this is that the Gandhians, quote unquote, the Gandhians, do not possess the spiritual force of Gandhi. They have faith in his doctrine, but cannot set into motion a movement of great solidarity because none of them possess the spiritual force of a Gandhi. And therefore, they cannot produce sufficient compassion, wisdom, and sacrifice. And he says, if we continue to be dragged along by the present machinery of producing and consuming, it will be difficult to build a spiritual force for ourselves. Anyhow, there is a need to be a human being again. So that's Enkhis, the regeneration of man. Again, for those of you who are familiar with the kind of popularized teachings these days, this is, I think you would acknowledge, this has a little different flavor, a little different force. And this is where he really comes from. And again, this came out of a man who looked deeply into life. Now, how do you, how do you gain the spiritual, that he says, the spiritual force of Gandhi? Well, Gandhi was a man of deep practice, right? He was very devoted to his Hindu teaching. He was very devoted to meditation, and he was very devoted to a certain lifestyle of simplicity and of sacrifice that gave him a kind of power, a kind of energy, right? And we have to understand, if we look at, even the movement for equality, if you look at people like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or other people, they had a spiritual force, you see. It wasn't simply that they had ideas and doctrines. A lot of people had the same ideas of doctrines, but they had a spiritual force that came out of their spiritual life, that came out of their spiritual practice. And that's what we need. Where are we going to learn? And where are we going to practice? And where are we going to develop, each of us, that spiritual force within ourselves, and then can manifest it collectively in our society, if not in a community? Right? We can't do it by ourselves, can we? One, because we don't know the way, and two, because alone the forces these days are so powerful. Forces of materialism, the forces of just distraction and stimulation, the forces of junk culture are so strong, it's really hard as an individual to resist, isn't it? We need community. We need spiritual friends. So the last thing, and again, these are all wonderful topics. So this is a book called Friends on the Path. It's a compilation of different people, but mostly about Thai, from 2002. So this is in the 70s, this is Thai in the 60s and 70s, so this is, you know, 25 years later, more or less. And now he's what? Now he's a big shot, right? Then he wasn't a big shot. Now, then by then he's a big shot. He's a world... He's a spiritual figure. His books are selling hundreds of thousands. Many people look to him. He has great influence. He's the founder of Communities and Sanghas. So this is an article, well, it's probably a talk he gave, called Spirituality in the 21st Century. And he writes, it has been said that the 21st century will be a century of spirituality. I think it must be a century of spirituality if we are to survive. There has been so much violence, so much suffering, so much despair, confusion, and fear. So it must be a century of spirituality or no century at all. And then he says again, so now we're coming to the present day. Spirituality is something we can cultivate. You know, and many things pass for spirituality these days, like reading spiritual books, lighting incense, you know, talking spiritual things, you know, doing spiritual practices, you know, we think we're spiritual. He says, to be spiritual means to be solid, calm, and peaceful. This is his definition. To be spiritual means to be solid, calm, and peaceful, and to be able to look deeply inside and around us. So it doesn't mean just coming to Sangha on Sunday and listening to a talk. It doesn't mean going to church or temple, right? Or the mosque. That's not spiritual. Spiritual is about how we are. It means having the capacity to handle our afflictions, our anger, craving, despair, discrimination. It is being able to see the nature of interbeing, interconnection between peoples, nations, races, and all forms of life. Spirituality is not a luxury anymore. We need to be spiritual in order to overcome the difficulties of our time. This was, 2000. So now we are what? 40 years later? No, not 40, what am I talking about? 20 years later. 20 years later, right? And all of a sudden we may look back in the year 2000 and go, wow. Alone we are vulnerable, but with brothers and sisters to work with, we can support each other. We cannot go to the ocean as a drop of water. We would evaporate before reaching our destination. A true Sangha is a community that practices the teachings of liberation and becomes free. A true Sangha practices the teaching of understanding and becomes more understanding. A true Sangha practices compassion to become more compassionate. If we support each other, we will become much stronger. And we can easily resist the temptation of despair. The essence of a Sangha is skipping. The essence of a Sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. When you do not see these in a community, this is not a true Sangha. And he says, and you should have the courage to say so. So please, he's saying, the essence of a Sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. So please, if anybody in our community or visits our community and doesn't see those elements present, please have the courage to point that out. But when you find these elements are present in a community, you know that you have the happiness and fortune of being in a true Sangha. So anyhow, this is called Friends on the Path. You can read it yourself. I know this is kind of, we don't have too much time, but, are there any questions about what has been shared today? And you can chat them in. If you look at the bottom of your screen, there's a chat function, and Bill is back ably monitoring the audiovisual. And so Bill will see your chats and will say them out loud to me. And we'll maybe spend 10 minutes. I'm sorry, but I get carried away by Tai's early writings. So please, and anybody in the hall? Again, so. So if you have any questions about what been talked about or how to implement them, please chat them. Use the chat function to write them. And again, anybody in the hall too, or not? I mean, maybe, in, yes. Raven, is this going to be a brief question? Oh, no, because then I can repeat it. We don't need to give you a mic. Okay, so the question is? Yes. So Raven is saying, she's just kind of repeating that, you know, all this conditioning, all these layers that that have now been fabricated deeply into our minds. Yes. And now we are meditating. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Raven's saying, yeah, she's been working the program, and she can see lots of positive changes, but still there is this sense of dualism, separation. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that sense of self-identity, which is then allows us to feel separate from, is very deep. You know, infants don't have that. That's why they're so wonderful. They just open, it's all open, and there's no self, right? So that's there, but that's deep. Now, you know, it's a process of purification. I mean, we are all, every one of us are conditioned, which means we have views, we have ideas, we have biases. We cannot help it that we were all born into this world. We've all, you know, been exposed to this world. So, and our parents and our society. So don't be surprised if you feel and react and respond in ways that even when you know better still arise. Okay? It's a process of purification. It doesn't happen overnight. I mean, is that clear? But if you continue with the practice, you know, if these windows were totally encrusted with dirt, we couldn't see outside at all. And many people like that. They're just totally lost in themselves. But through spiritual practice, meditative practice, and other ways, we begin to clean up the window of our own mind, right? So maybe, you know, you're not, right? You can see out now. You can see more clearly, but the window still isn't clean. There's still distortion, right? That's what you're talking about. Again, it's a process of purification. But the wonderful thing is, at least in Buddhism, that it's based on this original purity. It's not based on original sin. It's based on original purity. You know it's here. You have the Buddha's own enlightenment to attest to it, and thousands of years of teachers and masters and ordinary people, you know, going through this process and saying, yeah, you know, separation can be ended. It's just because it's not real. You see? The truth is we are interconnected. Right? The truth is we are co-responsible for each other. What you do affects me, what I do affects you and the whole world. I mean, that's not just a philosophical stance. It's actually the way it is. Who knows that? The virus knows that. The virus knows that. It knows we're all interconnected. It's just following our pathways of connections, right? Effortlessly. And especially if we don't wear masks and if we don't socially distance, it will even be more effortless, right? So, I mean, this is where you have to, you know, Buddhism is not faith-based in a traditional sense. which has to do with the creator and faith in the creator and stuff like that. But, you know, but there is an element of faith here, which means you have to believe in the Buddha's enlightenment and what he said at that experience, and that, you know, it has been replicated for thousands of years. And everyone says the same, right up to this modern time, right? And so, you know, we can do things like we did today to give us a little sense. I mean, anybody can just look in their mind and see there's nothing there. Anybody can look directly in their awareness and see there's nothing there, right? But 2 minutes later, they'll be back in their conditioning and forget it. But if you practice over time, you know, that purifies, okay? Anything else, Bill?
Several questions have come in. So one is, communities of resistance resonates with me. How can we create this within our Sangha?
Well, I mean, in my own arrogant way, I think we've taken wonderful steps, to be honest with you. I think we're on the right path. I think we have a community. And I think people who come here are struck by the genuineness of people. I mean, I do a new members tea, just as our community has grown. You know, I'm not able to kind of know everybody anymore. Actually, I don't know. And especially with, the shutdown, you know. But I'm doing virtual teas. And I would say the predominant, which has convinced me of the truth of all this, the predominant, when I ask people, why did you come to Florida Community Mindfulness? There are many Buddhist groups out there, meditation groups, you know what I mean, why? And I would say, very rarely do I hear it's because of you, Fred, because of the teacher. So that's, I have to deal with that. And also this, I don't hear the first thing for most people saying, well, it's a Dharma, you have it, or the meditation. The interesting thing is many people, say, you know, it's the community. They say, when I first came here, I was just struck by the naturalness and genuineness, the way I was greeted, the warmth. And that, you know, there doesn't seem to be any politics, no posturing, no spiritual posturing. You know, people feel, you know, and to me, that is, you know, I think we are well on our way. I mean, we will grow. We've only had this building, what? And really been using it for what, maybe 6 years? I mean, I think this community's done wonderful. And it's not because of me, it's because of all the community and all the people who participate. Because I think people are very sincere about practicing, right? It's not just people just don't pay lip service. I mean, I'm involved in a Bodhisattva intensive now. I think we have close to 100 people in it. You know, I'm giving a retreat later this week on patience, you know, as an antidote to anger, and I think there are 80 or 90 people in it. I mean, so, you know, people are practicing, and I think that's significant, because only through practice a transformation occurs. You know, many people say, well, you know, we got to get out there. No, we have to do what Thay says. We have to become something of value to the world. And not just in our ideas, not just in our ideology, just not on our stands. Many people say we should be taking stands on this and that, endless stands. No. It's very clear. Thay's saying we have to become a kind of person that has spiritual force. And then when we go out in the world as individuals or communities, we'll be able to act in a meaningful way. But if we just have ideas and views and, you know, it'll be very weak. And that's why there have been many wonderful social movements in our country over the years, in the world. And yet here we are. Why is that? Right? As, you know, I mean, look at India now. You know, produce Gandhi. Look at America, Martin Luther King. I mean, you know, we've had, but the movements, and we're part of a movement, haven't had that spiritual force, because it takes time to transform, right? takes time to purify the mind. And that's, you know, we're impatient. You know, many people would love a drug or love to come in and have instant transformation. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. There are many other things can be done quickly. Developing spiritual power takes time. Developing a community that lives in awareness and harmony and all the things that Thay says takes time. It takes caretaking. You know? You don't just go, all right, we've done it for 2 or 3 years, now let's get out there. No, we'll be like all these other groups. They come and they go. Right? So if we want to establish something of meaning, we have to give, be present to it in a very meaningful way. I don't know. I'm rambling, forgive me. Is that It's 11:55. So maybe you could save them, and maybe there's a way that I could address them if they're different, you know, different than what we've talked about. Yeah, I'm. So maybe I could address them. You know, we're starting to do these little videos. Everybody likes videos these days, so maybe I can just answer them and post it in Mindfulness Matters or something. If anybody's interested, who knows? Thank you, everyone.